One, like to open the February 21st, 2013 session of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Good morning to you all. This morning, we've got several public hearing bills, the first of which is House Bill 2032. And we'll hold on for a minute while we get that witness roster. Thank you very much. And I'd like to open a, did I open a public hearing? I don't think I did. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2032. And Beth, if you could please give us an overview of that bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2032 addresses payments for off-site compensatory mitigation to the Oregon Removal Fill Mitigation Fund and addresses varying costs depending on where the project is located in the state. There is no revenue impact, no expenditure impact. It does currently have a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
All right. Thank you very much. And I'd like to call up first Director Abrams. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Abrams, and I'm the Director of the Department of State Lands. I'm here today with Bill Ryan, who is our Assistant Director for Wetlands and Waterways. We are here to ask for your support of House Bill 2032. House Bill 2032 would improve the department's ability to provide mitigation credits to developers around the state by making the cost more equitable across the state. And as a bit of background, since 1967, the department has implemented the state's removal fill law, which includes assuring mitigation for unavoidable adverse impacts to waters of the state through activities on the ground. Mitigation for these types of impacts can happen either on-site directly or through purchase of mitigation credits. And these credits can be purchased from commercial mitigation banks and or from the state itself. The department has our own mitigation fund. The use of mitigation credits for cases where individual mitigation projects could be extremely costly or not very efficient is a very good way of achieving cost effectiveness through economies of scale and allowing for a more successful mitigation because you're working on a larger piece rather than small 0.3 or 0.1 acre mitigation efforts. Currently, the department's mitigation fund uses a statewide average cost estimate for establishing the cost of mitigation credits. This average cost approach has some unintended consequences. It overestimates the true mitigation costs in areas with low costs, such as in rural areas where land costs might be lower, construction costs might be lower. And it underestimates these same costs in areas with high costs, so urban areas where land costs are more are higher and where construction costs might also be higher. It also fails to differentiate between the cost associated with mitigating for wetland impacts or stream impacts, and those can have very different costs associated with them. So with House Bill 2032, the department proposes to improve the equity of the department's mitigation fund by allowing cost calculations based on the true cost of mitigation, or if we don't know the true cost, using a more fine-tuned regional cost estimate that would be developed through rulemaking. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Yes, Vice Chair Esquivel.
So when we say that you get these credits from, you know, DSL, are these credits specifically in a bank where you have like an air credit example, an airshed credit, you have people that have those in the past, they turn them in and or lose them, but they go into a bank and people can purchase those, or are we just saying, okay, I'm going to sell you a credit? Are we creating the credit, or is it existing?
Chair, Representative Escoval, that we have a fund, and we look for projects where those credits can be used. And so we're working with people who are doing restoration efforts and applying those funds to those restoration efforts.
I understand that, but I mean, I was just wondering if it was a bank of credits, or is it just a credit like a monetary credit?
It starts out as a monetary credit until we have a restoration project, and with each restoration project, we have a certain number of credits that are there for sale.
Okay.
That's good bill.
Anything further? I'm not seeing anything. Thank you very, very much.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Next up, I'd like to call, please, Sue Marshall. Boy, I can't read this one either, Michelle. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. I'm here, Sue Marshall, for the record. I'm here on behalf of Tualatin Riverkeeper, who submitted some electronic testimony that I'll just briefly summarize. Tualatin Riverkeeper supports House Bill 2032. We believe the proposed changes is a more equitable way of calculating payments when off-site mitigation is required. Tualatin Riverkeepers are concerned about the ongoing adequacy of wetland mitigation because it is wetland mitigation that really is the vehicle to attempt to assure that there's no net loss of wetlands. So in as much as that is adequately funded and those projects are carried out, that will give the state a better opportunity to achieve that goal. The benefits of wetlands are many: flood control, fish and wildlife habitat, water quality protection, hydrologic function. We believe wherever possible, it's good to do that mitigation within the area, the watershed, where the impact is being felt, especially in urban areas where you can, the cumulative effect of development can have an impact, creating flooding problems and water quality problems within the urban area. But where that's not possible, the program does provide some flexibility where payments can be made when that mitigation can occur on site. We believe that this is a step in the right direction. It recognizes that the current system, some pay maybe too much, some pay too little. We think this is worthy of your support, and thanks for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Marshall this morning? Not seeing any. Thank you very much. Call up Oregon Department of Agriculture, please, Michelle.
Michelle here?
Not here.
She's out in the hall.
In the hall.
One Michelle.
Off the floor.
Hey, Michelle. What's the last name?
Are you on hold?
Mark Stingers.
Yeah,
Marcus.
She's out there.
Well, that's, she might have
farm at school. I don't know about that one.
She signed up on the wrong one.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yes. Second. So we're done.
We're done then. Is there anyone else who would like to testify this morning on House Bill 2032? Once, twice, three times. I'm going to close the House Bill, the public hearing on House Bill 2032. And
hold off till I get the letter signed.
Okay, all right. And I'm going to move to House Bill 2249. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2249.
No, this is a fund that we're getting money from BPA.
Yeah. And And first up on this bill, I have Kurt Melcher. And Chris is coming up too. Great. Good morning, gentlemen.
Yeah, morning.
Let me see if can you get in.
Since I neglected to ask the administrator to explain the bill, maybe you folks could do that for us.
Sure. Thank you. Happy to do that, Mr. Chair. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have with me today Chris Wheaton, who's our Northwest Region Manager here in the northwest corner of the state. So the bill, House Bill 2249, essentially is really an accounting bill, if you will. It creates a dedicated account within our accounting system for housing the Willamette Basin, Bonneville Power Administration's Wildlife Mitigation Funds. So it creates the dedicated account, and then it also provides investment flexibility so that those funds in the long-term account can be invested with the state treasurer in longer-term accounts that or funds that yield better interest, essentially, if you will, as opposed to just limiting us to investing in the short-term fund, which is our current limitation. So with that, Mr. Chair, we did provide written testimony. As I mentioned, the bill is really pretty simple and straightforward. I did want to give you a little bit of background, though, as well. So with the Northwest Power Act, I believe in 1980, Bonneville Power Administration was required to mitigate for wildlife lost wildlife habitat in the Willamette Basin. Finally, in October of 2010, Governor Kulongoski signed a memorandum of agreement with the Bonneville Power Administration, officially commemorating the long-term commitment. Over a 15-year period, Bonneville is committed to providing $117 million for this mitigation. And then, very importantly, and this is where the stewardship fund comes into play, they've also committed to spending $26 million to assure that those projects are monitored and kept up over the long term, which is why we're asking for the stewardship fund account. Much easier for us to track them in a dedicated account as opposed to have it keep a separate tally on the side from our larger state wildlife fund. And as I mentioned in the brief introductory comments, that then this bill also gives investment flexibility with the state treasurer to put the money in longer term, higher yielding accounts. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much. Do we have questions for our witnesses today? Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
I was wondering if you would characterize the money, the $117 million that's coming from Bonneville, as coming from the ratepayers.
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt, certainly any of the mitigation projects that are funded by Bonneville ultimately come from ratepayers. I mean, the electricity users are footing the bill, I guess, if you will.
Thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
The staff measure summary, it speaks about protection of a certain number of acres. And it says protect 26,537 acres. Who owns the acres?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger. So the way the program is set up, and I do have Mr. Wheaton here, and he can answer in more detail, but the way the program is set up, we make recommendations to Bonneville for projects. Any entity can apply for a project, so we have a broad spectrum of entities that applied over the past 20 years and moving forward as well, ranging from land trusts, tribes, local government, as well as state agencies. So any of those entities can end up holding either in fee title or in the form of a conservation easement.
Please.
Are those areas open to other activities, hiking, fishing, hunting, those type of things?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, certainly one of our overarching goals at ODFW is public access is an important component of any of these projects. In the past, many of the conservation easements do not have any public access component. moving forward, we've, and I'll ask Mr. Wheaton to add in here, but moving forward, we've identified criteria to essentially prioritize projects, and one of our criteria is public access.
Public access, but for what purpose?
Oh, Chair Witt.
If I go look at it, that's different than actually utilizing it.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, for all the uses that we consider, that would be fishing, hunting, as well as just wildlife viewing or other recreational opportunity.
Very good. Vice Chair Escobar.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Krieger brings up a great point. We should never be setting aside a bunch of property in the name of the state or purchase it by the state and then court it off to the public where they can't utilize that natural resource, because that's the reason we want those, is to enhance our natural resource ability in this state. And I think that he makes a very valid point that we don't want to court that off. We want people to enjoy it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Thank you. Anything further?
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next up, please, Michelle Pope.
Michael.
I'm sorry, Michael. Boy, I need to put on my my glasses. My sincere apologies, sir.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, I am Michael Pope, Executive Director of Greenbelt Land Trust. We are a 501c3 nonprofit land trust with a mission to protect working lands and lands of natural beauty for the residents of the Mid-Willamette Valley. For the lands under our protection, we believe that it is our obligation and responsibility to be good neighbors. And a major part of our organization's energy and time is directed to providing good stewardship and management of these lands. However, there are a few funding sources dedicated to the long-term stewardship and maintenance of natural lands in the Willamette Valley. An important agreement was concluded between the State of Oregon and Bonneville Power Administration in 2010 that allowed for the protection of critical habitats for fish and wildlife in the Willamette Basin and resolved the remaining wildlife mitigation obligations associated with the construction and inundation impacts from the Willamette River tributary flood control dams. A key part of this agreement was the recognition and the commitment to provide long-term stewardship support to ensure that these habitats are well managed and maintained. We believe that the establishment of the Willamette River Basin Bonneville Power Administration Stewardship Fund, as described in HB 2249, is an important next step in the implementation of this agreement, and encourage this committee to support the creation of this account. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you have a question?
Yes, Representative Witzel, please.
Thank you, Chair. Do you anticipate that any of the acquired 16,000 acres of land will have been taken from previously working agricultural lands in the Willamette Valley?
I expect that some of the lands that are probably marginally important for farming will be converted to habitat for fish and wildlife. And those are particularly lands that are maybe have poor soils or in floodplain habitats that are frequently inundated by the Willamette River.
Please. Could you guarantee that no EFU land will be taken for this in the Willamette Valley?
No, I can't. So many of the lands that we do work with are because of the zoning or zoned for EFU. And yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
And for those who may be listening in with the public, we're we're discussing exclusive farm lands. Yes, Representative Krieger.
Do we know, Mr. Chair, depending how that ownership or where it's changed to, does that reduce then the property tax, or is property tax paid at the same rate to the county, or do the counties have a reduction then?
Representative Krieger, Chair Witt. We, our organization, for any lands that we own, we pay whatever the property tax rate is. And if we hold an easement on a property, the landowner is fully obligated to pay the taxes, whatever that rate is. So.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. On property taxes, if you're a nonprofit, does that freeze those taxes, or do they continue to escalate like everyone else on property?
Those property taxes are paid at whatever rate the county or the city.
That isn't what I asked you.
Yes.
Are they frozen or not?
They're not frozen. They're kept at whatever deferred rate they are.
So they continue to escalate like everyone else's?
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. I've got a deal going on in my
this relates to it. Thank you for that information.
Anyone else? Thank you, Mr. Pope. Appreciate that. Next, please, Bruce Taylor, and I think we're going to call up Tom Wolf at the same time. Bruce, great to see you. Good morning.
Thank you very much.
Hi,
Bruce Taylor with Defenders of Wildlife, and I'll be very brief. This is a pretty straightforward bill. I just wanted to put in a plug for the program, which I think is good, and as you've heard about, it's been in the works for a long time. Actually, Bonneville has been funding some mitigation on a case-by-case basis for more than 20 years, but the obligations here are probably more than 50 years in the making there, and it's taken quite a while to really get to the point where between the state's agreement with the Bonneville Power Administration, now there's a programmatic approach to dealing with these issues. And I think the real significance of this bill is that we're taking the stewardship component of that, which I think everybody agrees is really important for long-term maintenance of those lands, and putting it in a dedicated fund where the state may actually earn a little interest on it and extend those dollars a little bit further. So good program, good bill. Support it.
Very good. Thank you. Good morning, Tom. Good
morning. Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited supports this bill, 2249. We believe it's a good bill that puts money into it that could be used. In the 1990s, there was a book produced, and one of the authors is sitting right next to me, called The Oregon Living Landscape, that identified the 10 distinct ecosystems in Oregon, and one of them is the Willamette Valley. And due to the fact that a lot of people, 70% of the population lives there, there's a lot of farming. A lot of the unique parts of the Willamette ecosystem, such as oak savannas, prairies, many wetlands, rated sections of the Willamette, are gone. And this fund will help us to identify and protect some critical habitat that is. There's not much left, and one of the reasons that Trout Unlimited is so supportive of this is it also acquires property that the public can use, so that fishermen can use, hunters can use, bird watchers can use, and money that is spent in those communities that they go to use those properties will make it into the economies of the stores, restaurants, and hotels in that area. It's a very important part of anything that Trout Unlimited supports. So we support this. It's a great bill, and it will bring some money into acquiring and doing restoration on land that is very valuable to fish and wildlife in Oregon and doesn't always have enough funding to do things. So we support this bill, and we urge you guys to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panelists? Yes, Representative Clinton.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I've got, you just used the word acquire property, and I'm wondering what your view is on things like easements and versus acquisition of property. That's a huge topic. Another committee I'm on, and somebody down there might start talking here in a minute about acquisitions versus acquisitions of easements, access easements, conservation easements versus holding title to property.
Representative Clem, Chair Witt, our organization works a lot with private landowners, and wherever possible, we actually prefer easements. I'm not sure that acquire is actually the word I meant to use, but we do work quite a bit with private landowners. In fact, that's kind of a segment of our restoration. So in the long run, we believe that easements are a better way of getting things done rather than straight out acquisition. So,
thank you.
Okay, anyone else? I know, Tom, you mentioned some of the 10 different kinds of lands that were prioritized as important. And you happened to mention a prairie, and I remember when I was on OWEB we, of course, had X amount of money to purchase lands, and we had prioritized 10 of them, I think it was, at that time. And there was a very small piece of prairie just west of Eugene, I mean, literally outside of the city limits. And one, it would be hard to imagine that there would be a natural, original piece of property in Prairie State left that close to the city. And we managed to, even though it was a small piece of land, and probably because of that, we were able to find the necessary funding. It turns out it was a critical piece of habitat for, it's a blue-colored butterfly that I don't remember its name, but that kind of prairie was absolutely critical to the maintenance of that species. So it is can be a very, very important program. So Representative Whitsitt.
I just want to clarify, will the state own title to these lands, or who will own the land, the 16,000 acres?
I could take a stab at that. I think that's really for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. The way the program is set up, though, the title holder depends on who is buying the land. So in some cases, it may be a local government, it may be a land trust, it may be a tribe. They would hold the title. The Department of Fish and Wildlife could own land as well, but they are primarily in the position of providing recommendations to the Bonneville Power Administration which projects to fund, and then they administer the stewardship fund that you're talking about today.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, I think you're detecting a grave concern here that we're going to take monies, we're going to acquire land, we're going to put it into either tribal or whatever entitled, and not allow the public to utilize that. That's the big concern, because the public's paying for it. The public should have every right to this land to utilize it to the utmost of their ability. And I think that's the message that I'm picking up there. And I know I'm adamantly for that, because if we're going to pay for it, and by golly, the public should have access to that land, period.
Representative Esquivel, Chair Witt, this came up quite a bit when on the committee that I served with, in as far as setting criteria, and ODFW and many of the groups there were very adamant that access by the public being able to use it, it was an important part of this program. So, there's still a ways away to develop fully, but I share your concern, and my past experience with land owned by the different land trusts is they always provide access to the public. So I think that your concerns will be addressed in an adequate manner.
Follow. Please.
And I heard of a situation of where there was public, there was lands acquired, it was turned over to a city, the city in turn shut it down to hunting and only allowed like 2 permits or something like that. I think Representative Krieger and I were discussing that.
That's almost a crime to me. You're taking public money, you're acquiring public lands, and then you dissuade hunting and fishing in that particular area. I think that's a crime.
Representative Krieger, I need to wrap up this panel quickly so that we can shift to another bill temporarily. We'll come back to it. Would like to accommodate the speaker who needs to testify on another bill. So if we could get this one answered quickly.
Well, I would just say that if it is acquired, perhaps we need to be looking at an amendment. And I think at the same time I say that, not every piece of land that's going to be acquired is suited for hunting.
Right.
There may be a piece like this butterfly ground, depending on the size, that maybe should be the focus. But I think we need an amendment to the bill to guarantee the access to the other uses.
Okay. Any additional questions very quickly for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. With that, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2249, and I am going to briefly open the public hearing on House Bill 2649. Beth, if you could give us a brief overview of that bill, please. Welcome, Speaker Kotek.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2649 would remove a requirement that's currently in law for grants to purchase organ food products and to fund certain educational activities be allocated in specific percentages. It also appropriates to the grant program $5 million from the general fund.
Thank you very much. We're honored to have you, Speaker Kotek. Representative Clem, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your graciousness in allowing me to testify on a time certain. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative from House District 44, North and Northeast Portland, and the Oregon Speaker of the House. It's really a pleasure to be here this morning, my first opportunity this session to testify on a bill. And you are now getting to witness the Clem and Kotek show on farm to school and school gardens. We've been working on this topic since our very first sessions together. And I think what you're going to hear from a wonderful selection of testimonies is true progress on this topic. You know, starting off in 07, building the infrastructure in the state to support schools, to support farmers, to support the integration of the two in the schools, to build school garden curriculum, even to the point where we've been able to find money in the budget for grants. And I know you're going to hear about all the wonderful grants that have just gone out to school districts across the state to connect agriculture and even aquaculture from the coast with our schools. I just wanted to be here to say I still believe this is an incredible initiative. It's never had any what I could see serious opposition. The challenge has always been, how do we fund it? How do we provide those dollars to help supplement the meal programs in our schools who frankly don't have enough dollars to do the innovative work, to buy more local, to do the curriculum that we know helps students not only be interested in, you know, fresh products and local agriculture, but just being able to eat it in their school cafeteria. So I would like to issue a little bit of a challenge. I would assume that you will like this bill enough that you will do like other committees and send it out unanimously to Ways and Means. Before you do that, I would hope that maybe you'll give a little consideration, figure out, is there something else in the budget? Somewhere across ag and natural resources, or even business development, or somewhere else in the world that we need to redirect some dollars of farm to school. Is there a direct funding source that we could consider? I've said the same thing to the advocates. I suppose as someone who's a chief co-sponsor, I should have an idea as well, but I am open to working with all of you to figure out how we can put more money in this program. It creates jobs, it helps agriculture, helps our schools, helps our kids. You can't get a better thing that everybody really loves. So I just hope you'll support it and do more than just move it to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem. And I think it's interesting, the speaker's last point, because yesterday I was in my office and someone was talking about a budget request item that they've got, and I was thinking, yeah, no, that's not as important as farm to school. Yet I know it'll have some traction, so I'm starting to think more in those terms, too, about, and someone out there right now is trying to remember if that's their thing talking about. But I do think, from a just purely economic development perspective, that this is, for just for a moment, forget children's health and, you know, lower food miles and that kind of stuff. Purely economic development perspective, it is one of the single best bangs for the buck to help Oregon agriculture, to have guaranteed known income streams relatively close. You know, sometimes it's Kimberly to Portland, but still relatively close compared to where food goes in this world. And knowing that you've got the stability for your ag operation, that you're going to have X amount of sales in a given year, helps you do a lot of other things. Buy equipment, figure out if this is the year you can finally switch crops, graft something else onto your rootstock in our kind of business. But you don't do those things when you don't know in a big worldwide commodity market if you're going to have any guaranteed income in particular. So it's a critical, I think, economic development tool. And we've often talked about it in those ways. Mm-hmm. But to me, that means you got to put it up against every single other economic development thing we already do to see if it really returns this kind of reward to the state. And especially once you factor in children's health, childhood obesity, you know, lower food miles, that kind of thing, then it's clearly a no-brainer. The best way to get that is hear the stories of people who have already been in the program, and you'll hear from some people who never were able to sell to Oregon schools before and now do, had been selling to other schools around the country but not ours, even though they're based here. So that, you know, I don't want to go on because you'll hear from them about those stories. For me, you know, I got started in this sitting on a tractor before I was in office looking at the school literally adjacent to our orchard going, I wonder if our pears ever even end up in that school, because we don't sell our pears directly. I had no idea if they ended up, you know, literally 30 yards away from the nearest tree to the nearest school building. And it turns out they don't generally. Didn't, because we don't help the schools with any funds, so they do their best, but that often means whatever the USDA procurement list says is the cheapest, that's what they end up buying because they don't have any resources from the rest of us. When Representative Kotek and I started talking about this our freshman year, we both realized the importance of what the other one had heard from their constituency groups. I hadn't thought much about the school garden concept at all. I was just thinking about the farmer getting some contracts, and I learned from folks about the importance of having the kids really understand through gardening in their, on their school premises, you know, what's really going on at the farm as well. And without the gardening, they're not quite as interested. I mean, you can do a farm tour, but when they're growing it themselves, it's a much different deal. And certainly, I, you know, I bring in what it means to farmers to the conversation. So it's been a good partnership. You know, she's kind of the redneck. I'm sort of the urbanite. That's yeah. Just people know about us. Oh. Well,
so we're hoping to get your support.
Yeah. Speaking of Kotek, can take her name off this bill if she so desires, huh?
I'll wear that moniker with pride. Thank you.
Representative Krieger, please.
I don't know if I've talked to anybody ever that doesn't support this. Oh. This. It's a good bill. It's something we need to do. It is economic development. I'm just trying to figure out how I can get the Speaker of the House to come in and sit down on one of my bills and support, because she will make it happen.
Do you have any redneck bills,
Representative? We have abundance of those.
This could be the beginning of beautiful relationship. Come on over and visit.
Representative Whitson, please.
I was just wondering if every school district will have the same opportunity throughout the state to have an allocation of funds per capita to them, meaning some of the rural high-altitude districts that can't grow a lot of fresh local food.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, the way the bill is structured, because we don't believe we would get to full funding for a per capita deal, it's grant-based. So everyone has access to the grant process, and you'll hear about, I think, 13 that got grants. If we get to full funding, which we'd love, though the number in this bill currently doesn't get us to there, then there certainly would be opportunities. The one thing you reference that's important, actually, that I forgot to mention, and someone back there will probably be happy now this is here, we did, you'll see, delete out the completely kind of prescribed percent that has to go to procurement versus gardens, because in some places there may not be a garden opportunity. That would, so you'll see that's deleted in from current law and the current program. So we need, you know, more funding, a little bit less restriction. The other thing is it really actually says 87.5% and 12.5% exactly, not 12.6. And so we need to wiggle that language anyway by taking it out and then just leaving in the bottom part of the bill what the priorities for the grants are, you know, economic development, promote healthy food activities. You then leave the grant or the ability to do some of the things in places where, you know, the otherwise prescriptive language was causing it not to be possible.
Mr. Chair and Representative Whitsitt, the full freight, if we were going to do 5 cents a meal to help from the purchase side, I believe is about $12 million for the biennium. Mm-hmm. And that was our calculation, that schools who wanted to all could all participate in the meal reimbursement. So that's your goal. Go see if we can find $12 million. But just the other thing is, I'm a big promoter of fresh, but I also believe in the process aspect of this. We've had a lot of schools who have taken Oregon products, had them processed, so you get the added value of not only the locally grown, but the process. You know, because for some schools, it's not about fresh, it's about trying to get Oregon processed foods into their programs as well.
Okay,
that's a good point.
Additional questions or comments?
I want to thank our distinguished panel very, very much. Certainly appreciate your comments, truly appreciate the bill, and agree that this is a tremendous economic development bill. I just want to share the experience that I had, I and my staff, when we went on a tour to Sobeys Island this fall, a farm to school. We had two classrooms of kids from the local school. We went out into the fields, picked fresh greens, went back, made our own salad, and then fresh tortillas. And I just for the public record, I want everyone to know my very first tortilla. Perfect.
Absolutely. You made your own tortillas.
I made my own tortillas. Plural. So
nice.
I'm
impressed.
So with that, thank you very, very much. And I'd like to speak with you later on, Madam Speaker, about corn to shine. So when we get a chance.
Sounds good.
Thank you very, very much. Take care. With that, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2649. And just by way of explanation, I know that there are a lot of folks that showed up for this bill. We changed the rotation on the bills to be able to accommodate the speaker. We're going to get back to all of you that want to testify on this bill here in just a minute. So with that, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2249. And I'm going to call up, please, Sue Marshall and Rebecca. Is it roped? Roped? Please come up.
Hello again.
Welcome back.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm here on behalf of Audubon Society of Portland and the Willamette Riverkeeper, both of whom support House Bill 2249. Both of these organizations participated in the advisory committee that was tasked with trying to figure out how to use this money. Just by way of background on the Willamette project, the Army Corps of Engineers in the 50s and 60s built 13 dams and reservoirs. They also reinforced banks along 93 miles of the Willamette, which greatly channelized the river, further reducing fish and wildlife habitat. There were widespread and many benefits from these projects, flood control being high on the list. There's also recreation, hydropower, municipal and industrial water supply. And farmers benefited. The water stored, some 1.6 million acre feet, were available for irrigation. There were, prior to all these projects, huge returns of anadromous fish. The cost that offset those benefits were largely borne by fish and wildlife and water quality. At the time, it was thought that hatchery fish could offset, and that was the mitigation of choice. Well, we've learned a lot since the 50s and 60s on what was necessary, and as a result of these projects, there are many species that are threatened and endangered with extinction. This fund will provide some immediate and very strategic restoration projects, and the hope is that it will reduce the short-term risk of extinction, especially of Chinook salmon, whose risk of extinction is considered high. I know there's been a lot of talk about who will own what property and easements versus acquisitions. I think there can be, land can be compatibly managed. Farming in some cases can continue and still be compatible with riparian restoration projects. As far as ownership of property, actually I was reading through the biological opinion last night, and the Army Corps of Engineers held many of these properties where they had done the bank reinforcements, and those have then subsequently been turned over to Riverside property owners. We think this is a good project. The bill itself just provides a vehicle for the money to go to on agreement that the state has already made. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
My name is Rebecca Roth, and Chair Witt and committee, and I'm talking because I'm concerned about the direction that our country is going in terms of property rights and government intrusion into that, the Kaiser project property rights were taken away from the owners there and turned over to other people who developed the Kaiser Station, and that was a gross violation of property rights. And whenever there's a fund set up by the government, it's able to be used against property owners in ways that can violate their property rights. In the 1800s, the governments, both nationally and states, used their power to take away land from the American Indians. And the Republican Party formed over that issue. That was one of the issues, along with slavery, because we wanted to see the lands not in the government hands. It's not the government's purview to hold lands. In America, we're a free country, and our founders intended for the people of the country, both the native people and the new European ones, to own the land and not become like the type of government that existed in Europe, where there was an elite type group that owned the lands and kept the people off of the lands, kept them from using the lands, and then there were the poor people. And our founders wanted us to have property rights so that the average person could have land and have confidence that their land cannot be taken away by the federal government or
Rebecca,
the state government.
If I could interrupt right there, and you make a very valid point, and I think a very historically accurate statement. This bill, however, does not involve the takings of people's property. These are folks who enter into this arrangement on a willing basis.
I understand that at this point. I'm concerned with a violation by the government of individual people. There is that going on. I talked to a person up in the
Rebecca, I'm going to have to interrupt you and recognize the problem that you describe and the concerns that you have, and I think they're shared by a number of folks, but we have a very long list of people who need to testify today, and this bill really is separate and apart. I am absolutely convinced from your concerns, and would be happy in a different forum to hear more about those concerns, but I have to move the agenda, and I have to keep testimony focused on this particular bill.
My testimony is focused on this bill. We're going in the direction of taking people's property rights away from them. It's going on across Oregon and across America.
I understand that.
I'm done.
I understand your concern.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate both of your testimonies. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to speak today on House Bill 2249? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2249, and I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2649. And the main event today, I think that's why everyone showed up. Mm. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Cassandra Griffin, Rick Sherman, and Michelle Markstein.
Yep.
Good morning to all of you.
Good morning. Chair Witt and members of the committee, my name is Cassandra Griffin. I work on food and school health at Upstream Public Health, hence this is my favorite topic. Several years ago, some of you and some of your predecessors created positions to work on farm-to-school and school gardens in the Oregon Department of Agriculture and Oregon Department of Education. Thank you. Those agencies have done a great job, along with partners from OSU Extension, at promoting farm-to-school and school garden programs to schools and to farmers, and have helped leverage public-private partnerships to get those programs going. Hundreds of Oregon schools are now buying at least some Oregon food products, and thousands of Oregon kids have gotten more educated and more excited about their food. But we are now pushing the limits of what can be accomplished without additional resources, and there is much, much further to go in terms of supporting Oregon farmers and Oregon kids. I'm here to ask you to expand the grant funding for farm-to-school and school gardens to $5 million per biennium. Based on the health impact assessment that Upstream conducted in 2011, funding at this level would provide local purchasing support for 28.5 million individual meals, which is approximately one-fifth of the school meals served in the state. It would also create 65 jobs, would improve the health of students, farmers, and Oregon's rural economy. $5 million would change this from a test pilot program, which is underway and going well, to something big enough to transform the purchasing patterns of school districts all around Oregon, benefit thousands of kids and dozens of farmers. Regarding the issue of guidance versus flexibility that Representative Clem touched on, the original language of House Bill 2800 was very strict about requiring every single grantee to have the same percentage split between procurement and education programs. The current version of House Bill 2649, in contrast, provides complete flexibility to the Department of Education so that grants can respond to local needs. We are happy to work with you to reinsert some statutory guidance about the allocation of procurement versus education, or to leave it wide open and flexible. We can work either way. We do hope to increase the flexibility from where it was last round, though. Now, in my efforts to be concise, I have the pleasure of outlining who else you will hear from today. First, we will hear from the farm-to-school staff at the two state agencies. Then we have three folks coming up, or four, who are involved in the House Bill 2800 pilot grants: a farmer, a processor, and a school food service director. Then we will hear from an anti-hunger advocate and wrap up. I have handed in packets for each of you that include materials from all of us speaking today and also from a number of other people who couldn't fit into our timeline today or couldn't make it over the mountains but who wanted to represent their support. So thank you for your interest, your past support, and we stand ready to answer questions.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and members of the Agriculture Committee. For the record, I am Rick Sherman, Oregon Department of Education Child Nutrition Programs Farm to School School Garden Coordinator. Also in the room is Joyce Doherty, my boss, the ODE Child Nutrition Program Director. And my position is designed to help school districts with farm-to-school and school garden efforts. I provide technical assistance, help school districts make connections with local vendors, and help share resources and ideas between the districts. I'll be sharing very briefly two initiatives that that we have developed that support House Bill 2649. The first is Oregon Harvest for Schools. This program was developed to promote and educate people about Oregon-grown produce. It includes large posters like the one you see right here, multiple large posters, classroom connections, education materials, and printed newsletters and menu slicks. Please see examples in the of the posters as well as other materials such as the newsletters in your packet. These help students and also their families get familiar and excited about some of the local products that are served in schools and help food service directors develop menus. In addition to the hard copies that we distribute around the state, and over 47,000 items have been downloaded from our website since 2011. The second initiative that I want to talk about was our pilot project, as Cassandra talked about, the House Bill 2800 grant. This grant program, many of you voted to create in 2011. The legislation provided $200,000 for ODE to make its grants to school districts for them to purchase and serve products produced or processed in Oregon and do food-based, agriculture-based, and garden-based educational activities. A few little bulleted facts about this. 20 school districts applied for the grant. During the application process, numerous school districts that I was in contact with told me they would have applied if there were more funding available in the grant, but they chose not to. 11 school districts were awarded. We have the attached list in your packet of those 11 schools with highlighted items that they are doing for with this grant money. In accordance with the legislation, grants went to school districts that represent a variety of sizes and geographic differences and locations. There is also a great diversity in the products they're purchasing. School districts are purchasing Oregon beef and seafood, as well as grains, fresh and frozen produce, and local processed foods. Thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any of your questions now or later.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Witt, members of the Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources, thank you for the opportunity to present today. Good morning. My name is Michelle Markiston Ratcliffe, and I am the Farm to School Program Manager at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. You know, 5 years ago, when we asked school food buyers what they needed to purchase more Oregon agricultural products, we heard that they were starting to buy Oregon foods, but that kids didn't know about it. And at that time, schools needed the tools to be able to promote what was being served to the kids and their families, and needed to connect what was really happening in the cafeteria with the classroom. So Rick mentioned the Oregon Harvest for Schools, and this is what was developed to meet those needs. And we've been working with the commodity commissions and producer groups to expand the toolkit to include the whole plate, so seafood, beef, dairy. And then 3 years ago, when we asked school food buyers what did they need to purchase more Oregon agricultural products, they said they were buying more and promoting it, but that didn't mean kids were eating it. And what was identified was that students really needed to have multiple positive experiences, like tortilla making in the garden, with the food in order to eat it. If kids eat it, schools will buy it. So we responded by hosting Food Corps, a National AmeriCorps service program where members volunteer for 1 year in an Oregon community, and they focus specifically on farm-to-school and school garden activities. In its first year, four service members served 8,290 students. They generated over 300 volunteers who logged over 2,400 service hours themselves. Now in its second year, Food Corps members serve in these five counties, and we also have the first Food Corps fellow at the Oregon Department of Agriculture who is working to launch a Boat to School initiative to make sure that coastal communities are connected to the rest of Oregon and kids can enjoy seafood.
And Chairman, yes. When you finish up.
Okay, I'm almost done. Great. And then last year, we again asked buyers what did they need to purchase more Oregon agricultural products. And they noted they were buying them and promoting them, and that students were starting to have more positive experiences with food, but that kids weren't coming to school ready to eat. Basically, the healthy items that schools are serving are not necessarily ones kids experience at home or elsewhere in the community. So schools actually asked us, they said, hey, could you help us change social norms and culture around eating and food? And so we responded by piloting a multi-platform promotion that includes television, print, and web pages, and achieved this level of impact you can see here. And I was going to show you one of the segments that we did specifically on farm to school. And from this, you'll be able to see, there you go. Sorry, I'm a Mac user. It's painful. This is what farm to school is at its best. It's about procurement, promotion, and education. And those things happen in the cafeteria, the classroom, and the community. October is National Farm to School Month, and that means it is a great time to celebrate Oregon's farmers, fishers, ranchers, serving kids all across the state.
My name is Molly McCarter. I am a fourth-generation farmer. Our family farm's name is Pyrmine Farms. Farmers in Oregon are growing food, and it's getting to our schools locally. It's not traveling from Brazil, Chile, Mexico. It's coming from Oregon farms to Oregon schools. Corn is our, acres-wise, is our biggest crop. We plant the corn in June. We grow it all summer long, and we harvest it in, hopefully by mid-August, end of August. We grow contracted acres for NOPAC. NOPAC is the largest cooperative in the Northwest that processes vegetables, and it's right here in Oregon. You know, we see it on our end, the raw end, and then seeing it on the finished end is pretty fascinating to see it go through the lines and how they sort it and how quickly it's done and how quickly it's in the freezer and ready to go to the distribution. All the vegetables that we grow is processed within 8 hours of leaving the farm, and so it retains more of its nutritional value than anything that travels for a week. We're a part of several programs. One of them is an adoptive farmer program where I visit schools and then kids come to the farm and they get to make the connection. They get to see where their food's coming from. We talk about how we grow everything from planting, what seeds look like, to planting it, how it's planted, how we take care of it, water, fertilize, pest management, you name it, I try to talk about it. Kids love the tractors. You know, that is the coolest thing, to see a huge tractor, to hear it set up, to see it driving around. It's like a big toy, and it is for farmers too. It's extremely important for our kids to make the connection where their food comes from. And when the kids see the food, grown, they know where it's, they've met the farmer, they see it, and then they're eating it at lunch, they have a different appreciation for the food. They are more likely to buy fresh corn, fresh beans, or even frozen canned goods. They know what fruits and vegetables look like, they've seen it growing in the field, they've seen it in their cafeteria, lunch, and so they go, oh, I'm going to eat that because I met the farmer that grew that, and she was pretty cool, and so I think I might like corn. You know, Willamette Valley is probably one of the best places in the world to be able to grow over 200 varieties of things, and we have some of the best maritime climate. It just provides a long growing season, the right growing season, and we've got fertile soil, and I wouldn't trade where we live and what we do for anything.
Knowing where their food's coming from and being connected to the people in place where their food has been produced, it's a great opportunity to give your kids what they need for a happy, healthy life.
Great, thank you. And I'm happy to answer any questions at this time.
Well, thank you very much. Questions or comments? Vice Chair McKeown.
Oh, just back to something you said about Food Corps. Can you tell me a little bit more about Food Corps?
Sure. Chair Witt, Vice Chair McKeown. That Food Corps is a national service program, so an AmeriCorps program, that was started last year and was piloted in 10 states. And so Oregon was one of the first 10 states to host this new national service program. And members, they apply from around the country. It's actually harder to get into Food Corps than Harvard these days. And you have to, you do about 1,700 hours of service in the community. And it takes about 1 year. And in exchange, members get $15,000 living stipend and then educational award after that.
I'm going to make this really easy. It's McKeown. I know it's really hard, and you all get a pass because I'm new. But I have had the privilege of training AmeriCorps members for a number of years in another life, and I hadn't heard of Food Corps. Is there a chance to continue to grow that program? Those federal, state, public partnerships are really valuable, and the skills that I saw them bring into the state from all over the country in a program that I worked with were amazing to watch. And I just wondered if there's an opportunity to escalate that. If we fund this program at a larger level, can you expand on that Food Corps program?
It definitely would give
I'm trying to think, that we are working to scale up with Food Corps National in Oregon, so we're looking to scale up to 8 okay. to, or 10. The reality is it takes about one, as you know, full-time staff person to run the program as they do that. And fortunately, we have the new fellow position at the Oregon Department of Agriculture. But it is a phenomenal public-private partnership for each, you know, each member. It brings in about $35,000 right. of funding into the state, and then they turn around and generate an enormous amount of activity right. for them. But that would be worth something looking into, quite frankly.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitson.
Thank you. I have just a series of questions that are interrelated, so I'm going to say them, and I think you can answer them probably with one. Could you describe the procurement process to determine which farms will be selected to sell to schools? Because I anticipate you'll have a lot of farms that want to sell. And will it be a competitive bidding process? And consequently, will this allow small farmers to be competitive, or will the large producers have an advantage because they can grow the food for less expense? And on top of that, do you anticipate a ban on genetically modified foods through this program in the future?
Can you take that? These two first two points.
The first two points, and you'll get the GMO one?
No.
Yeah, you don't want to catch that? As far as the first two points, as far as the procurement for...
Purchase.
Yeah, the purchasing, when we do the grant, the school districts have their own process that they go through to procure that, and that we don't set the rules than that, other than the schools follow the local purchasing, the purchasing guidelines. So they go through their own competitive bidding process, and they go depending on if it's a small or large a large amount in terms of how they purchase that. But as far as the GMOs, that thing, I haven't heard anything about a ban on GMOs or anything like that. It's always a very controversial topic, as you know, but we haven't.
I would step in there and say that this bill does not touch the subject of GMOs. It also doesn't touch any other aspects of agricultural practices. It doesn't prioritize one type of growing over another, either at the level of scale or agricultural, organic or conventional or anything else. It supports all types of Oregon agriculture.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you very much.
May I follow up?
Yes, please.
Just thank you, Representative Whitsett, for that question, because it sparked me with something else. Is there any kind of distance, I guess requirements, too strong a word, but grow local, buy local? Is there any provision that would incentivize schools to keep it close to home?
The bill language specifies that products that qualify are grown within Oregon boundaries. I believe that Oregon school districts have the discretion to specify more narrow local preference standards, but in some parts of the state, that's not very feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the current grantees from the House Bill 2800 funds include Joseph and Ontario and North Powder over on the other side of the mountains, higher up.
Mm-hmm.
And so those school districts are going to procure what they can local in their communities, but also be buying some things from the Willamette Valley where we can grow more easily. But I believe that the Lane County school districts that received the grant do prioritize buying in Lane County. So school districts have the discretion within it must be Oregon boundaries.
Please.
But it would not preclude a district from, for example, paying a little bit more a pound for a product that they could get 10 miles away as something that would come from farther away at a lesser price because they can grow it in greater quantity, for example. Does it give them that discretion?
Yeah, as long as they spell out and they make it a free and fair process for everyone, if they define their local as, you know, like Cassandra was saying, I want to do it in Lane County, but they give everybody the opportunity in Lane County to bid on whatever, that would be fine. It's just within reason, I think.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. Can you talk a little bit about how Farm to School might, in the long term, start to connect with some of the other, as you saw in the video, and you can imagine the amount of crop that one farmer is going to produce is going to far exceed what one school needs. And so, that's one of the challenges with programs like this is you grow 80 acres of corn. That's a lot of corn for a school of 500 kids. Are there ways for us to piggyback this program into other social services that the state provides? And what steps are we taking to try to kind of close the loop on that part of the program?
Thank you for the question, Representative Unger, Chair Witt, members of the committee. The Farm to School movement has really been the trigger for a larger farm to institution movement. And this legislation, this focus right now, is narrowly, we're asking for funding for the Farm to School program. But broadly, we are seeing hospitals focus on local purchasing. Some communities are asking government agencies, such as the prison system, to focus on local purchasing and to take every opportunity to drive local money into local producers to support the economy that way. And as we saw in the video, some of the education that is coming out of the farm-to-school efforts is really designed to educate families and communities about their individual purchasing decisions as well. So we're hoping that this program overall is supporting Oregon farmers in multiple ways.
Yes, please. This isn't really a follow-up. This is a different question. Do we have, as we're doing this program, I'm assuming that cost is one of the biggest concerns because we create this program because we can't afford to buy locally without a little bit of subsidy. Do we have a target for how much we're paying in addition per meal for kids? Or is cost a part of the equation? Are we trying to bring down the cost of local food as we do this? And is that part of the discussion as we make some of these decisions and grant decisions? And are the schools thinking about it? Or are we thinking about it?
As Representative Unger, Chair Witt, members of the committee, as with everything, there's a factor of economies of scale. The bill language allows for up to 15 cents per meal to subsidize local purchasing. So if you're asking about a specific dollar amount, that's the dollar amount, is it allows that 15 cents per meal. And that is usually towards one product to subsidize a local purchase of something that would otherwise be non-local. The more schools get into the habit of buying local, the more I think they will find opportunities to do so without always an extra cost. Once you have those established relationships, have those distributors, have those connections, there is the opportunity to increase the amount of local purchasing, which doesn't all need subsidized. Some of it does.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Klemp.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one thing I thought might be interesting to note on the farm-to-institution side, when, as the Speaker and I talked about, we started this in 2007, but we didn't get any procurement dollars. We just got the Department of Education position funded. The Department of Ag position funded in 07. In 08, we got the Department of Education position funded. Sometime in 08 or 09, we figured out that if we actually had procurement dollars, they would have not been legally able to be used because it was unlawful until 2009 for any contracting agency to give a preference to any kind of good or service under contract law for being based in Oregon. So in 2009, we changed the law on just food. So any institution of government, at least, that was contracting could buy from an Oregon grown producer at a higher cost. I didn't realize that when we were first doing it. So luckily, I guess in some ways, we didn't get the money because no one could have used it. So at that point, that changed a lot of procurement behavior in other institutions. For example, the state hospital now buys a lot more. The idea for the bill came separately to both then Representative Cannon and myself, one from the Multnomah Food Policy Council, one from a grower here in Salem who couldn't sell to the state prisons anymore because of this contract language. So farm to institution has started to blossom in part because the structural barrier was eliminated in 2009 for contracting agencies. They weren't allowed to pay 1 cent more at all. I mean, they couldn't pay 1 cent more even if it was Oregon versus China. And so that's changed a lot of behavior. Then last session, we expanded that to all goods and services, all desks, papers, utility, you know, anything other than construction. But a little history on why we didn't get more institutional buy-in probably earlier.
All right. Vice Chair McEwen.
This may be getting a little bit into the weeds, Chair Witt. But the 15 cents a meal, we have a lot of rural communities who provide breakfast and lunch and sometimes take-home snacks for our students who live in dire circumstances. So does the 15 cents apply to a breakfast also, which would be a lower-cost meal? How would that factor in if you have a rural district that's very poor that's serving?
Representative McEwen.
McEwen, thank you.
Yes. Chair Witt, members of the committee. The original proposal that we started with last session asked for a subsidy to breakfast and lunch, and what we passed in House Bill 2800 last year had scaled back and only provided the 15-cent subsidy for school lunches. And so this is a proposal continuing in those footsteps. But if you wanted to make an amendment to expand the program to breakfast, we would be behind you 100%.
I said I was at risk of getting into the weeds. But
anything further? Not seeing anything. Thank you all very, very much. Next panel, I'm going to call up. We're going to hear from a farmer, Tom Hunton, from a processor, Peter Truitt, and from a grant recipient, Pam Leslie. You and welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Our preordained order is that I will represent or Chair Witt.
Please proceed.
My name's Tom Hunton. My wife Sue. We're farmers in the Junction City area. Small grist mill, flour mill that we process and sell Oregon-grown products. And I'm delighted to support this House bill today and try to relate to you how our business, although our mill has only been open less than 2 years, how we've reached out to schools and schools have reached out to us and the benefits to both of us. Expanding outreach and sales from our farm and mill to Oregon school districts has been a rewarding business and enjoyable experience for us. And we'd like to see those relationships expand both for us and for other farmers. Selling Oregon-grown products to Oregon schools not only offers us a new market as farmers and processors, but it increases the strength of our regional food system, integrates rural and urban communities, provides kids with good nutrition that they may not get otherwise, and connect kids and their parents to where food comes from. Sue's a retired sixth grade school teacher. She and another lady that works for us do the tours at our farm and our mill. And I'll let her talk about when we have the opportunity for kids to come visit the farm, see grain growing in the field, go to the mill, grind it, and pack it.
Good morning. I am Sue Hunt. I taught sixth grade at an inner city school in Springfield. And the process that we do, which is just seeming to be overwhelmingly fun for everybody, for the mill and for us and the kids, I meet the kids out at the farm, which is about 5 minutes from our mill at this time. And they get off the school bus, and usually there's a field that they can go and touch the grain or touch a bean or touch something and put it in their hands and actually put it in their mouth and feel that grain or feel that bean. Then I talk a little bit about what it is and tell them that we're going to go to the mill now and we're going to actually see that grain being ground into flour. So they get back in their school bus and they go 5 minutes to the mill. And then we greet them at the mill, and they come in, and we show them the grain that's actually in the packages that they saw in the field. They put on their little hairnets, which is always the really fun thing. And they go through over to the mill, and they sit down, and I have another teacher that I had worked with that actually sits them down with a concrete slab kind of thing in a rock, and they actually grind the grain into flour and actually touch it. And then we show them that this is what Indians used to do a long time ago, pioneers used to do a long time ago, and now this is how we do it here. So they put the grain in the mill, and I have a worksheet that they can follow the track of the grain that goes to the mill. So they watch and hear the mill going. And then after that process, we turn off the mill, and they go over and they package a little package of that grain that has just been milled into a little bag, and they make a little label and color on it so they can actually, you know, identify with it. I give them a sample of a muffin, an apple carrot muffin, that is baked with that particular flour that they get sent home with a recipe. The teachers love it. The kids love it. You know, they come back and they come to the market and go, hello, and I'm like, oh, they must have come to the mill now. I don't know who you are, but, you know, they recognize me, and we've made that connection now with the kids and their parents.
So that's part of this bill. The larger part's for procurement, and this last year, a little over a year and a half ago, we started supplying whole wheat flour to the Bethel School District. They bake muffins and bread and so on with grain that travels a grand total of 15 miles from the field to our cleaning facility to the mill back to the school. In last fall, started with the Bend Lapine School District, which we now, they consume pretty close to a ton a week of whole wheat, hard white wheat flour, which we bill as Stealth Health. It's a whole grain flour that has a little lighter color, a little sweeter flavor than typical hard red spring wheat, and the kids love it. Kids get it there virtually all through the day in meals, from breakfast muffins to pizza dough to sandwich loaves, sandwich loaf breads, and so on. Just a phenomenal program there. And these are just, now we're working with North Santa Am School District. They're testing that flour. And so here we are just getting this kicked off and showing just the tremendous diversity that's possible. And so if we could get more adequate funding and support, more farmers could get quality products into Oregon schools, and this food could reach more Oregon kids. By the way, I'm not, don't know all of the purchasing parameters of Bend Lapine, but we were able to come in and save them cost over sourcing an Oregon processed but Montana grown grain. So there are cost savings in some instances too. So we're going to support the health of Oregon kids. We need to also support the health of Oregon agriculture and make this a program focused on getting food grown in this state to our schools. So if anything, I'd like to see the language tightened a little more, and maybe there's preference points, you know, I have a bias because we have farmers in our area and on our own farm grow these products. It's processed, providing jobs both at the farm level and at the processor level. But it's also interesting because I've had growers come to me and say, I heard you talk about what you're doing with the schools. Can I raise some of that for you? So in this spring, in the next month and a half, there will be a field of hard white spring wheat planted in Lane County or two. They'll have a sign that says these are grown for the schools. And they'll have first chance. Those schools will have an opportunity to have their bakers come and tour that field and come to the mill and have it on their website so that, you know, we make that connection. we don't want this just as transactional. We realize we have to be close in costs and so on. But there is so much we can do on relationship building between rural and urban folks with help with this bill. It'd just be phenomenal. It's, you know, it's scalable, and it's truly a multifaceted and program that we could do wonders with. We thank you for your time.
Well, we certainly thank you for your testimony. We'll finish the panel and come back to questions. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Witt and members of the committee, it's nice to see you. My name is Peter Truitt of Truitt Brothers. We're a Salem-based food processing company that processes and packs food like beans, soups, and chili. Many of our products leave in cans, but we are increasingly using alternative packaging like pouches and cups. We employ about 600 people here in Oregon and source many of the ingredients in our products from Oregon producers. We've been doing business in Oregon K through 12 school districts for several years, including Portland Public, Jervis, Eugene, Salem-Keizer, Albany, Medford, Woodburn, Ashland, and Bend La Pine. As the state has forged innovative ways to improve the K through 12 menus in Oregon, our company has become more attentive to new districts that have support from the state. Simply put, we're expanding the districts that we're servicing with some of the things that we do. The interest from Oregon schools has helped us change the way that we think about K through 12 business. Historically, K through 12 business was a fiercely bureaucratized model throughout the country, not just here in Oregon, but everywhere. And it really wasn't worth the effort. The school administrators and the purchasing programs were so straitjacketed. It was a poor investment of effort to get into that system. One exciting thing that we are exploring right now is a farm-to-school or school garden starter product. We've been selling this kind of product to a major child care facility nationwide for the last several years and are now expanding its application for K through 12 schools. It is a soup base that encourages schools to add products from their garden or their local vendors. It can stay a soup or it can become a sauce for beef or chicken or part of a casserole. We're excited about how it can bridge the divide between scratch cooking and prepared foods. And I might mention it could potentially ameliorate the cost of purchasing from a very local source because we do the hard part. We do the base preparation, and then a given district that may have access to a certain range of products that is unavailable in another area can then make something out of it using the ingredients that they have available. We make sure to exceed nutrition standards on our school products. For example, the sodium level on this product is 40% below the National Sodium Reduction Initiative guidelines established for 2014. So we're well below the level for 2014 already. So we're proud to be helping schools meet their sodium goals while also creating sustainable local jobs and providing delicious food. I brought along a sample of the starter kit example, which I'm going to let you pass around and take a look at. And you know, it's a pouch product. This is a 6.5-pound pouch. It's ready to serve. Goes in a steamer or a pot of hot water and warms up quickly, and then the ingredients can be added by the local kitchen operation.
like a starter. It's a starter kit for soup sauce.
Yeah. Thank you for your attention. I urge you to pass the bill, an expanded bill, for the sake of the eaters, the growers, our employees, who all benefit from this investment in Oregon agriculture and Oregon kids.
Thank you very, very much.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm Pam Leslie. I am Nutrition Services Director for Lebanon Community Schools just down the road. And I am a recipient of the House Bill 2800 Farm to School Grant. First of all, I'd like to say thank you. This has allowed us to do a lot with local farmers and local areas that we wouldn't have been able to do. And we appreciate you funding this. It has given Lebanon Schools the opportunity to purchase frozen blueberries from Springbank Farms right there in Lebanon. We have purchased frozen marionberries and strawberries from Willamette Valley Fruit here in Salem. It's been fun to watch the little kids in our district eat marionberries and then show their friends their purple tongues. And it's been a real education for us older people. We've purchased jicama sticks, which have been processed by Duck Produce in Portland. We've served them on our salad bars after we did tasting trays in the classrooms. 90% of the kids didn't even know what it was, along with several of the teachers. We've been able to purchase soil from Central Bark in Lebanon and seeds from our local Wilco Farm Store for our greenhouses in the district. We have already, with the help of the students, planted in the greenhouses for harvesting lettuce and peas and spinach and radishes in April and May. Another exciting benefit that the grant is allowing us to do is partner with our own Future Farmers of America. Nutrition Services will purchase meat that has been raised at their 10-acre land lab. FFA will prepare a marketing plan, find a USDA-inspected processing plant, sell to Nutrition Services the finished cut and wrapped product. This grant is making a difference for students and farmers and aspiring farmers in the Lebanon area. An expanded program could give this kind of benefit to farmers and school districts all over the state. And I could talk forever on the benefits of this. It's been extremely exciting for us to be able to expand the students' tastes with different products, and we appreciate that. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Plum, please.
I just wanted to make a comment. You know, when Peter and I first started talking about this, I heard the same thing you heard, which was at one time it was not really, it wasn't a good business move for them to look at Oregon schools, though I think maybe you had some schools in Georgia. And that was tough to hear, that our climate, I mean, their bulk of their operations are, you know, a few thousand yards from here, just along the water. And now, actually, it got drawn into my district, so now it's in, most of their operations are in my district, but it was tough to hear that one of the few canneries left in what was known as a cannery area doing wonderful things viewed our school system as such a bad customer, it wasn't worth looking at what other states were. So to hear you say we've been doing it now for several years is a tremendous, tremendously rewarding thing for me. But that was largely, I mean, we think we've put a total now of like $200,000, you know, period, into state procurement. And so at some level, we have to make these investments to grow this because we've had private foundations and schools hustling and doing everything they can to make it happen. But it's not going to grow, I don't think, without some, you know, without some carrots from the legislature to get the schools who aren't the early adopters, who don't have the funds to be able to figure out how to do it on their own, to go further. But I want to thank True Brothers for making this a huge part of their sustainability efforts that they've engaged in, flying people here from over the country to look at what Oregon does and featuring this, and part of their business model, obviously, to think about how to do it. We just have to do our part and be good customers.
Absolutely. Representative Reardon.
I couldn't support this program any more than what I do. I think it's really important to the kids. I've seen way too many kids that are eating frozen pizzas for breakfast and lunch, and I kind of prefer this alternative. My only question may be actually too broad, but the question really has to do, I don't understand what the drivers are, why local foods cost more. I'm just new to this committee, so why are they more expensive? It just, and assuming there's a good reason, what do we need to do to help drive those down so that in the long run, local foods are more available to schools, to other institutions, and to the people that live in poverty in my district? I want them to be able to buy your products. I'd really prefer that if we didn't have to subsidize that in some way. So that's the, we've gotten a challenge from the speaker this morning. How can we get more money for the program, but long term, how can we get out of the business and subsidize it?
Representative Reardon, I'd like to respond to that. It's not farm to school, but we have a special place in our heart for two things that we have been critically involved with in the last year and a half. A little before Christmas a year ago, Food for Lane County approached us because we were doing beans and lentils and grains that were kind of new to local food, and said, what can we do, because we're desperately short of protein sources. Commodity prices are relatively high. We don't get surplus cheese from USDA or meats like we used to, and when we get funds, they're more expensive. So we put together samples for them, very simple. Green lentils that we grow and other growers grow here in Oregon and in the Northwest, and a hullless barley that's the lowest glycemic index grain. We've got a nation of diabetics, and so here is wonderful nutrition. It's not pearl barley. We've got much better characteristics. And put that together for them bulk. They said, we want to enter into intentional growing. In a month and a half's time, we had a project on the ground that involved five other growers growing lentils for the first time in the Willamette Valley, and this hullless barley. We delivered it bulk, nearly 100 tons this fall, to the Oregon Food Bank, who they jumped on it once they saw what Food for Lane County was able to do. And this week, I'll be getting back to Mike Moran at Oregon Food Bank. They want 250,000 pounds of it grown this year. They're paying a very small premium, less than 10%, over a brokered market for a Canadian lentil, or you know, unknown origin, to one that's grown here, delivered to them fresh, and so on. So these are the kinds of opportunities that come about, and that's local food. That's our next step, is those kinds of things. Maybe we can partner with Peter's company to put it, because so many schools don't have from scratch capabilities anymore. But we dropped their price point on proteins way below what they were doing at the food bank level, and we love that too, because we are feeding all the socioeconomic stratus.
Further questions or comments?
Just, you know, one big driver is the federal USDA program and the subsidies that exist on certain things federally. That brings the cost down, where a normal grower, like for example, we grow pears, it's not subsidized federally. So when a school is looking at a list of what they can get through their program, it's artificially cheap because of federal programs.
That makes sense.
And that's a big part of it. The other, of course, is the conditions at which some of our competitors grow their products are severely different. They don't pay in Argentina and Chile the same wages I pay to have somebody pick pears. And the environmental rules I follow are far more safe and appropriate than what they do in other countries, yet we sell in the same grocery store right next to each other with no label, you know, particularly that says this one's grown with this and this one isn't. So there are cost differences that are ones we probably wouldn't want to get into, reducing our costs. We'd probably prefer their costs went up to match what we do to keep our fruit safe and healthy in my particular case. But it's, I think, for the schools, mostly the bulk deals they get from the feds are tough for growers. Not always, though. Obviously, sometimes people can match it, and that's happened. But it is a little challenging to try and do that until that program stops subsidizing certain foods, and then you get more of a market price.
Okay. you. Representative Unger.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question. As far as a job creator for your companies and your farm and your processing plant, do you know how many jobs have been created by this program? And is there significant room for growth if we double, triple, quadruple the size of the project?
It's hard to identify, Representative Unger, what it's done to for our firm, because the school portion of the business is relatively small. At this time, we're a fledgling company on the milling side. We're less than 2 years old. Our farm is, family's been there for 60 years, but we see it improving the sustainability and viability long term of our farm to bring back this variability and diverse crops that have always can be grown here in the Willamette Valley and other areas, and it's just starting to get the momentum. So I can't say that it's been measurable yet.
I can't answer off the top of my head, but I can derive it from the products that we actually have sold to the school, so I can derive that information, get at it.
It Maybe is. I'll follow up with you at another time and try to learn more about it. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further? Yes, Representative Reed?
Somebody mentioned that some schools may not be able to actually take advantage of this program because they don't have kitchens. There's other districts that do not have kitchens these days, so they're...
Thank you.
Sadly. Very sadly.
I think I could speak to that if
Please
you
do.
Like.
There
was a move a number of years ago to centralize kitchens within districts or contract out with organizations that actually bring food into the building. And I can only speak for my school district, but there are a lot of schools where you could not bake muffins. Yeah, they have warmers, and they bring food in and serve it already prepared. But I think that this is the whole trend that's changing now. We're going back to a more kind of land-based local approach. So you may see school districts going the other direction. But it was a trend when federal subsidized made food really inexpensive. They brought in meals that were already prepared. But I think it depends on the district. I think the more rural and smaller the district, the more opportunity you may see. But it became very commercialized over time, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And we hope the trend will reverse.
We certainly do. Shop classes and back to real food. It's
there you go.
Pretty good. That's great progress. Yes, Representative.
That's sort of the role of the processors and food manufacturers, we call them. There's a few businesses, ones here in Salem, that they know there are schools who lost that infrastructure and may or may not ever rebuild it. And so that's where, Peter's company makes a chili. It's still made here in Oregon. It's made Oregon stuff. But it creates a link for the schools who didn't lose the infrastructure to do any kind of prep. This other one here in Salem, they're called Fresh and Local Foods, and they assemble the whole lunch. So they'll do the whole lunch here, deliver it, within hours of being made to their customers all around. So it's creating these kind of food entrepreneurs who are bridging the gap between the farmer and the schools because of these farm-to-school programs and combining it with that loss of infrastructure. Then other schools are definitely rebuilding kitchens. The one right by my house got some kind of federal stimulus grant and put back in kitchens. That's where my daughter will go someday, so I'm kind of excited about scratch cooking. But that all this has been incubated and innovated around this over the last 4 or 5 years, I'd say, here in Oregon.
Can I respond to that also?
Please do.
We have been asked by a K-12 district, actually outside of Oregon, to formulate meals in 10-ounce trays according to certain nutritional guidelines and exchanges, vegetable exchanges, protein exchanges, and whatnot, for a dinner program. That is kind of a new thing, but it is happening. That those same kind of meals could be formulated and provided either at either a lunch or a breakfast, depending on the item, for those very sorts of kitchens that are those very sorts of districts that don't have kitchens. And it's sadly common in a lot of places around the country, school districts that don't have kitchens. So it can be done. We're doing it.
Good. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank this panel very, very much. Pam is a former student who I think oftentimes we get treated to a Korean War surplus food. I want to thank you for making available not only real food, but food that tastes great. And Tom and Sue and Peter, thank you to each one of you for doing business in the state of Oregon. It's important. You're part of the backbone of our economy, and we certainly appreciate the fact that you have chosen to carry out your business here in our state. Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. With that, I'd like to call up our final panel. And folks, if there's anyone here for House Bill 2782, I'm going to have to carry that bill over. We're simply running out of time. I apologize to anyone. Is there anyone who's traveled any distance to testify on that bill and can't make it back another day?
The lady over there.
We have one person. What I'll do is we'll try and get to you just very quickly to take your testimony. With that, our final panel on 2649, please, Robin Johnson, Sandra Griffin, and Tricia Smith. Welcome, each of you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Robin Johnson. I'm the Public Policy Manager for the Oregon Hunger Task Force. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2649. And in the interest of time and your great interest in this program, I'll just take a moment to leave you with a couple of points. This year, over 306,000 children qualify for free and reduced price meals at school. They depend on the meals that our cafeterias are providing to be nourished and to be prepared to learn during the school day. So as the economy continues to recover and children and families continue to rely on federally funded nutrition programs, including meals at school, to help their food budget meet, the food budget ends meet, it seems that House Bill 2649 is a wise investment for our state. It will help reduce childhood hunger. It will increase food security. And is a great investment, as we all know, in Oregon agriculture. So we urge passage of this bill, and I thank you for your time, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Who's next?
Go ahead. All right. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and I am here today to happily provide our support to House Bill 2649. We represent many food service workers in Oregon's K-12 schools, and they are very excited at the changes that have come about just in the last few years as a result of the legislation that this body has passed, encouraging farm-to-school and local production and delivery of food to schools. They're excited because they know their kids are going to get a healthier meal. And they're excited because the kids know what they're eating, rather than some, as I like to call them, chemically based food-like substance, which is not how they refer to them. We believe that this is a program, even in these very tight budgetary times, that we need to continue. We, OSEA, introduced House Bill 3046 this session to continue the appropriation to the farm-to-school program, but we support House Bill 2649 as a better alternative than just a continuation. We think it makes good changes to the program. I was in Reynolds School District a couple of nights ago, and one of our custodians there stopped me after the meeting to tell me how excited he is that he has been building the boxes. What do you call them?
Raised beds.
Thank you. Raised beds, I knew that. Raised beds in their common areas that the kids are going to be planting vegetables in. The kids are excited about the project. The food service workers are excited that they're going to have fresh vegetables for the kids, and it's a great program. So we encourage your support of 2649, and we stand ready to help any way we can.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
And Chair Witt, members of the committee, Cassandra Griffin, Upstream Public Health again. Melissa, I just wanted to be at the panel at the end if you had any more questions. But I have one more point I wanted to make that we didn't address yet, which is we have talked about this from the perspective of food service and hunger and farmers and processors, and we haven't talked about it from the perspective of education very much. And I want to draw a picture for you of a visit that Representative Clem and I were on to Grant Community School here in Salem a few months ago, where we saw third grade students talking about their exercise building compost bins and their experience in the school garden. And the executive director of the Salem Kaiser Education Foundation, Karina Lemons, was there with us then. She wanted to join us today, but she didn't fit in the time. And she made the point that garden education is the most perfect STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, for the third grade age set, because they're learning about, for that compost project, they were measuring, they were designing, they were building, they were hammering, they were getting outside of the classroom, working on a real project, they were thinking about how big it needed to be to hold the volume, so they're doing all these math and science measurements, and then they're working in the garden to learn about decomposition, to learn about the cycle of life, to see growing things, and to get the health education messages also. So I want you to think of this not just as good for farmers, not just as good for hungry kids, but also a core part of the educational experience that we can offer. So with that, we are done. We stand ready to answer questions.
And can I just add one more thing, Mr. Chair?
Please do.
About a year and a half ago, OSEA is an affiliate of the American Federation of Teachers, and about a year and a half ago, our president, national president, Randy Weingarten, came to Oregon, and one of the main reasons she came was to look at our farm-to-school program and our school-based garden program. And she toured the gardens in Lake Oswego School District and was taking that information back to share with affiliates throughout the rest of the country.
Wonderful. And I suspect, Tricia, you don't have occasion to testify before our committee all that often. Welcome. We're glad that you're here.
Happy to be here.
And we're so pleased that all of you have lent your voices to what appears to be virtually unanimous support for this tremendous program, this tremendous bill. And we certainly appreciate all of the support that it's receiving. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I am going to close the...
Comment, please.
Yes, please.
I'll make this very brief, but we've talked a lot about the need for local foods, which I've always said I totally support. I also think it's important that districts be encouraged to use local community members as their employees. I think that how they staff their kitchens is important, that these are, in my experience at David Douglas anyway, that these families that work for the districts provide the best service and would be there best able to serve this food. So.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2649. That was a tremendous testimony, by the way, folks. And I am going to very briefly open the public hearing on House Bill 2782 to accommodate a witness who would have difficulty coming back, as we're going to have to carry this bill over. Good morning. Welcome to our committee. Ms. Fitzpatrick?
Yes, thank you very much.
Please.
Thank you for allowing me to have a few minutes here to talk about House Bill 2782. I am Nancy Fitzpatrick, Executive Director for the Oregon Salmon Commission and the Oregon Albacore Commission, which are industry-funded state commodity commissions under the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And I represent the ocean commercial salmon fishermen and albacore fishermen. And both of these commissions support House Bill 2782 that will allow us to amend the rules relating to the number and geographic representation of our commissioners. Over the years, without any rules or laws telling us to, our commissions have tried to make sure that we have fishermen from the North Coast, the Mid Coast, and the South Coast so that we're representing the entire fisheries. And this would allow us, this bill would allow us to then put it into administrative rule to make sure that future commissions can have that appropriate geographic representation. And currently, both of my commissions have nine commission members, and the bill would allow us to augment that number or decrease that number if we needed to adjust our representation accordingly. So we currently want to support this because it will clarify the administrative rules for our commissions and the authorities that we can move forward with. So it's very basic, and I thank you for giving me these few minutes and for hopefully your support on this.
Thank you very, very much. Are there any very quick comments? Seeing none, thank you so very, very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2782. Committee members, I need a quorum. We have one piece of business we absolutely have to get done here today. I'm going to open a work session on LC 3364. Representative Reardon would like to have this bill introduced as a committee bill. Beth, if you could please give us a brief overview of that.
Mr. Chair, members, this bill would restrict the operation of motor vehicles of a certain weight in beds and banks of certain waterways.
Committee members, I'm sure there are none of us who have ever had a bill come out of a legislative council, not exactly as how we would have preferred it. Several of us have talked individually, and I know that some of you have concerns. I have my own. I have gotten a commitment from Representative Reardon that he is a willing amender for his own bill. With that, Representative Reardon, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Really not too much to add to it. It was the issue was portrayed as, you know, huge vehicles running up willy-nilly up and down streams, ruining fish habitat. It certainly was not an intent to restrict responsible access and ability to cross streams and so forth by hunters, farmers, or whatever. So I would just really appreciate the opportunity to work through that with whoever's concerned and see if we can do something that makes sense.
Thank you very much, Representative Reardon. I appreciate that commitment. At this point, I recognize Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Witt, I move that LC 3364, dated February 12, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill.
Vice Chair McEwen moves LC 3364, dated February 12, 2013, be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, hearing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none, hearing none, so ordered. And with that, I am going to close the, we are adjourned.
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
You said you were going to carry that over, right?